House Committee on Business and Labor for February 18th, only February 18th, 2013. First thing I'd like to do is open a public hearing on House Bill 2443. Kate, could you summarize the bill, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2443 allows licensees of Oregon Liquor Control Commission to sell wine and cider in certain containers supplied by the consumer.
Thank you. The first people we have on our first panel is Dan Jarman, Harry Pedersen Nedry, and Greg Ponites. You come forward, gentlemen.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. I'm Dan Jarman, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. Thank you very much for having the hearing today on House Bill 2443, important legislation that would allow certain OLCC licensees to sell wine and cider dispense into refillable containers that the consumer would be able to enjoy later off-premise. We've termed our bill Wine Growlers because it mirrors what brew pubs and other on-premise licensees can do today with malt beverages. We'd like to accomplish three things today. First is to let you hear about this important legislation from two important members of our wine industry, and I'll turn it over to those gentlemen in a moment. Second, we'll discuss what the bill does, how we've constructed the legislation, and then finally we'd like to discuss two amendments that the Oregon Wine Growers Association has crafted that we'd like to be added to this legislation. You'll be hearing about another amendment later from the beer industry, and I'll let them take care of that amendment. First, I'd like to ask permission of the chair if we can have some visual aids that we would use during the hearing, some two wine kegs, and then you can see we've got three wine growlers that are currently used at wineries.
Okay, no problem.
Thank you very much. The first person I'd like to introduce is Harry Pedersen Nedry, who is the founder, winemaker, and managing partner of Shehalem Winery and Vineyards, located in the North Willamette Valley. Since 1980, Harry has been deeply involved in seeing our Oregon wine industry grow, mature, and flourish. He has served on the Oregon Wine Board, including as chair, on the Oregon Wine Growers Association Board, including as president, and on Wine America, which is the National Trade Association for the United States wine industry. Also joining me today is Greg Ponites. Greg and his wife, Cara Omo, own Wooldridge Creek Winery in the Applegate Valley in southern Oregon. Greg and his wife, Cara, are probably most responsible for this bill before us today, and I'll let them share that story with you. They've been doing growlers in their tasting rooms for a number of years now, and they have retailers in Ashland area and other parts of southern Oregon who have been very much wanting to have these growlers go out of those licensed premises. So we'll talk. I'll let Greg talk about that during his time. So if you would indulge me, I'll turn it over to Harry Pedersen Nedry to make remarks.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair and representatives, I appreciate the ability to come here and talk about something that we're pretty passionate about.
Before you get going too far, if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm Harry Pedersen Nedry from Shehalem Winery in Newburgh, Oregon.
Thank you.
I'm passionate about wine first, but I'm also passionate about new ways of interesting the average person in wine as a beverage for the table. In order to do that more and more, we have to take it out of the effete realm. We have to take it out of let's buy a bottle and age it for 10 years and put it in our cellar and bring it out at some special time. Wine in some regions of the world that grow excellent wine, as we do, in those areas, they treat wine as a normal beverage for the meal, for the table. And we think growlers or containers that the average person can feel free to go and refill on a regular basis goes in the direction of giving the capability to the average person to consider wine something that they can get today and drink today. I think Greg will comment on some points that he made when we were chatting informally before this session about the fact that that's the way most people drink wine anyway. And what we're doing is trying to facilitate that and be on the cutting edge as far as other states in the U.S. We have for several years now as our winery, and I think several others within within the state, have used kegs to get wine out and available in restaurants. Kegs and those taps that you will see in modern restaurants many times provide the majority of the glass pours that people use to make certain they've got a single glass of wine to drink with their meal, and then maybe another one from another tap that is a different variety. Those are the type of things that add to the richness and the complementary nature of wine with food. We have, for the last 4 years, been providing kegs to restaurants. We provide kegs to 3 to 4 states, and there is an exponential growth in that in other areas. This is an offshoot of that. This basically suggests that we can accomplish several things with growlers. One is we can integrate it into the daily part of life for the individual consumer. We can also, in that process, remove packaging that ends up being not as environmentally sensitive as we can be with reusable containers that we suggest here, growlers or whatever you want to call them.
What we up here are calling Le Petit Growlet.
Merci.
Let's sound a little more sophisticated with our high-end Oregon wines.
And now we know who's carrying the bill.
Madam Chair, woman, I would like to suggest that actually be a part of the bill.
Yeah. Yes.
We'll call it whatever you want.
Let's thank our assistant, our committee chair.
Dash five amendment, I guess.
We also think that this is a big step in the direction of sustainability. These are individual containers that people, as consumers, bring in. We refill them as wineries now in our winery, but we're suggesting that it would be very smart for us to do that in normal places where people are educated in how to deal with the consumer and provide alcohol for them. This is really no different than providing a bottle of wine for someone, except that they get the chance to select and to basically fill their own container and deal with things in a very customized way. We think there is great interest out there. We've seen it in our own tasting room and winery. The sale of these has gone up, and over the last 2 to 3 years when we've had it within our own winery, and the keg growth in other parts of the country obviously is something that probably drives this even more, and we're suggesting that this would be a good move for the industry and for the state in general. We see it supporting an industry that through innovation has succeeded quite well over the last 10 or 15 years when a lot of other things have not, and we want to continue that to support the industry in that way.
Thank you. Do we want to wait for questions, or why don't we wait till the panel's done? We'll have questions. Okay.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Greg Panites. I'm with Wooldridge Creek Winery in Southern Oregon. Thank you for letting us come today. I suspect we're the first people who brought you kegs into the room. In the The summer of 2009, my wife and I were talking about the governor's carbon neutral challenge. We were sitting in a restaurant, a large pizza restaurant, looking at everyone drinking beer. And we ordered a glass of our wine, which was on the menu, and it came to us, and that glass of wine was oxidized and didn't taste very good. And we looked around the room and said, well, why is everyone drinking beer and not many of them are drinking wine? And we thought, well, because the beer people really know how to do this. Why don't we put our wines in kegs and start pouring them out of the taps so that every glass that is poured is perfect and is very well priced? You know, the other part of this is that when we put wine into kegs, we can also compete at a price point that's very competitive amongst the wine industry. So we approached a local brewery because we didn't really know what to do with a keg or how it worked, and said, will you teach us how to do this? That brewery is in Ashland. It's called Standing Stone. They taught us how to use kegs. That was in the summer of 2009. Standing Stone, in 3.5 years, has poured 45,000 glasses of wine out of our kegs in their brewery. So they have saved over 8,200 bottles of glass bottles, the same corks, labels, and foils. That's about a half truckload full of glass that would be going up and down I-5 that one restaurant alone has saved. So the other part of this is that through that level of innovation, Standing Stone, before we were pouring our wines there, was the largest Behringer consumer in Southern Oregon. So through the innovation of the kegs, with this this new pathway for us, we were able to displace a multinational company that is owned by an Australian group and keep the money locally in Southern Oregon. Where this moved to was one of the relatives of the people that own that business also started the Medford Co-op. And he came to us and said, I would like to start refilling growlers here in the co-op. And we said, great, let's go. So we started down the path. It became apparent relatively quickly that there needed to be some clarification as to the legality of whether or not they could do that. And that really points us to where we are today. In that time frame in restaurants, we, Wooldridge Creek, have put out kegs and poured more than 250,000 glasses of wine in the state of Oregon. We have saved multiple truckloads of glass, and it's something that we're very proud of. Today in the winery, this year we will surpass the amount of wine in kegs that we're pouring in restaurants than what we have in bottles. So it's a very exciting proposition for us, and one that we're very glad to be here representing.
Great, thank you very much. We have questions for the panelists. You were the first one to raise your hand.
Mr. Peterson, last name is Edry, is that right?
Nedry.
Well, it's nice to meet you in person, sir. My wife and I have been members of your cellar club for many years.
Well,
at your room
it's
time
so
to time.
Nice to meet you, too.
And we do cellar your product and bring it out on special occasions, but I appreciate your coming in and what you guys are trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good. Mr. Thompson.
One of the points I think we need to address for this bill, and it's a tendency we have here with a lot of legislation, is we look at this as we're breaking new ground and this is innovative, and it's really not. The rest of the world's been doing this for a very long time. If you go to Chile or to Spain, you go to a wine shop, half of it is refillable. You know, it's only here that we've got these ridiculous rules that put the lid on a local industry and keep it from moving to the next step. And I think it's a logical extension, time-tested in other places, and there's nothing really new about it. It's just we're getting up to date with what other people are doing. It does take a lot of glass out of the waste stream. I've been doing this for quite some time. I wish that I could do it in my local community, not have to drive as far to the winery to refill. Mm-hmm. But you know, I look forward to the time that we will replace all of this with the old-fashioned milkman, only these growlers will be delivered to my house. You know? Every Tuesday morning, I'll get my delivery on the front step. We're not there yet. But, I mean, just opening this up, it just puts us in a position where a lot of the rest of the world already is. I extensively looked at what are the problems in other countries with this, and nothing.
Thank you for the insight on that.
Yeah.
Other questions for this panel? Mr. Holme?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We haven't really discussed the amendments, but I just want to voice my support for the Dash 3 amendments. I think they're really important.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions this panel?
Madam Chair, may I talk a little bit about the amendments? There's no questions about the bill. Happy to answer questions about how we've constructed the bills, but you'll see there are several amendments to this bill. The first, the Dash 1 amendments, are ones that would, we think, is a very important and necessary safeguard, and that would require that anyone who is dispensing the growler at any of the license types that's authorized to do this have a valid OLCC service permit. We think that's a good way to make sure that wine that's being dispensed to the consumer, that the person doing that has got the training from the OLCC necessary to recognize issues when someone shouldn't be getting wine. So that would be the Dash 1 amendments. We strongly support that amendment. The Dash 3 amendments before you is an emergency clause. And the reason we've asked the legislature to place an emergency clause on this is that we would like to use this legislation, the ability to do these wine growlers, as the signature promotional effort for Oregon Wine Month, which is in May. And so we're very much hoping that we can have the governor's approval, the legislature's approval, and the governor's approval before that time, so we can really, from a promotional standpoint, use this to emphasize Oregon Wine Month, which is May of 2013. Again, you'll be hearing a third amendment from the beer industry, which we would greet as a friendly amendment, and I'll let them discuss that. And then finally, I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill today. It's also very nice bringing a bill to a committee in which the two chief sponsors of the legislation are on the committee. Special thanks to Representative Jim Thompson and Representative Paul Holby, the co-chairs of our Oregon Legislative Wine Caucus. Thank you for signing up many of the Wine Caucus members as sponsors of this legislation, and we hope that the committee adopts the amendments we've discussed and moves the bill to the floor, and we're happy to answer any more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. As someone who lives right off of Highway 99 and worked out of Newburgh and McMinnville for many times, it's I think for a long time people didn't appreciate the wine industry, and it is huge in Oregon. And not only huge in Oregon, but it's also huge nationwide. And Oregon wines are very, very highly thought of. So bring a little notoriety to the state of Oregon. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, the next two people signed up are Janine Grace and Nellie DeVries. And actually, if you want to have a third person, Gwen Baldwin, if she'd like to come up also. Thank you. Okay, who wants to start first?
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Janine Grace, and I'm regulatory manager with Widmer Brothers Brewing Company. This is, as you may know, the largest brewery here in the state of Oregon and one of the first breweries here. And I'm here to address the amendment related to malt beverages. I think this is pretty much a common sense amendment to add. I unfortunately did not bring a Widmer Brothers growler here, but we of course do make them in a variety of sizes and shapes, some quite collectible. So if you show up in Portland at a brewery, please give me a call, let me know, and I can show you some of the styles of growlers that we sell. Growlers, of course, are a product of the brewing industry. They originated from a time before pasteurization and modern packaging techniques, where the only way to bring your favorite beers home was to either bring the entire keg or to have a growler filled at your local pub. Although we now have bottling and canning and pasteurization and all of these techniques to allow you to bring home beer in a variety of different manners, for many craft brewers in particular, the growler is still the only way to bring the beer home. Even at our size, there are a number of beers that we only produce on draft. So if you want it at home, the growler is the only way to do it. So we think this is pretty much a logical addition to this bill. We've been working with the Oregon Wine Growers Association. As they mentioned, they are friendly to this amendment. I also should note that I found out about this bill when I was notified by a member of the OLCC who said, hey, this bill's coming up to add wine and cider growlers. You should get yourself on there and have the malt beverages added so that we have the same privileges that they do. So with that, if you have any questions, please let me know. Otherwise, I thank you for this opportunity to speak this morning.
Okay. We'll have questions when the panel's done. Okay. Next.
Chair Dougherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nellie DeVries, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. I really don't have much to add to what everyone has said before me other than to express our industry's support for this bill, for the record. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Hey, Ms. Baldwin.
Good morning, Chair Dougherty and members of the committee. My name is Gwen Baldwin, and I'm here today representing Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods strongly supports this legislation, which provides a really valuable product option for our cider, beer, and wine customers that we know they want and enjoy. Admittedly, growlers would not be my preferred marketing name, but
Le Petit Growler.
But here it is. Here it is. Growlers offer an option that is a perfect Oregon combination. It's thrifty, it's sustainable, it's responsible, and let's face it, the contents are delicious. Our local producers also benefit from a more affordable way to get product to customers than in traditional bottles, especially, as was said, when they produce small batches. Currently, our NorCal, South, Southwest, and Northwest regions all have setups for growlers, although not every store may offer them. We know how to market them. We know how to do it within a controlled environment that still keeps the product visible. I recently had the opportunity to see a setup for growlers in Tucson, Arizona, where the signage, reusable containers, and product were all located behind the deli counter. So there was always someone there to serve them, but in a controlled fashion. We have reviewed the amendments before you, and we support them as well, and we urge your adoption of this legislation. Thank you very much.
Fine. Thank you very much. Any questions of the panelists?
Just one clarification. Yes. You said you supported the amendments. That means all three that we've been discussing?
Yes.
Okay.
And the reason I brought this up, because I shop at different venues that apparently serve wine with the food that they sell. Mm-hmm. I did not realize that Whole Foods and New Seasons, some of these others, actually sold wine by the glass in their restaurants,
yes.
And so or in their grocery stores. So all of them have servers' permits and all of that kind of thing.
Correct. We have, when we are handling alcohol, we have to have the appropriate licenses, as well as a certain level of preparation in our stores. Some stores really qualify as restaurants, and so we also are properly licensed.
And certain security for the
absolutely
the kegs and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any others? Ms. Fagan?
Well, in an attempt to help you with your marketing problem, Growler, I moonlight as someone who amuses myself, and so I have proposed combining sommelier and growler with growlier.
Right.
That one's for free.
Yes.
But thank you. This is good work.
Growler just doesn't seem to fit into the wine
growlier
industry. So
growlier.
That growlier, we've got that. Any other questions? Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Now, we do have OLCC here if they have any comments. Questions? Did you want to? Okay, and Mr. Romaine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. We, too, want to say we're in support of this bill and the amendments. It's good. It applies to all wine, whether it's produced in Oregon or anyplace else, and it'll just allow more avenues to get the consumer whatever product they want. So we are very much in support of it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2443 and open up the informational hearing for an overview of the Workers' Compensation Division. If we could bring forth Patrick Allen and John Schultz with the Workers' Comp. News is going to think about this as they're carrying kegs out of the business of labor committee.
9 o'clock. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Joining to me today is John Schultz, who's the Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. You may recall a couple of weeks ago when I was here to give an overview of the department, while we were talking about workers' compensation, Representative Witt asked some excellent questions about data on results, particularly as they applied to how workers benefited from changes that have occurred over the last 20 years in the workers' compensation system. In sharing some of the data with him, he suggested, and Madam Chair, you graciously agreed, that the information that he was looking for and that we were able to develop some answers to really told an important story, and that given this committee will deal with the bulk of the workers' compensation legislation that comes through the House this session, we thought a brief overview of workers' compensation, talking about some of those results over the last period of time, would be something that would be useful. I think what you're going to find as we go through this is that there's an interesting story to be told around workers' compensation there, including at a time of some crisis in the system, the ability for businesses, for labor, for government to come together and come up with creative solutions that have produced really some exciting results. And yes, I am using exciting in the context of workers' compensation, believe it or not. What I want to actually do is take you all the way back, partly because I think sometimes we get used to thinking of government programs as things that have been around forever, and we don't always go back and consider why are we doing this in the first place. And for just one minute of the system, I'd like to do that. At the beginning of the 20th century, it's worth remembering that when work was generally physical in nature, if you got hurt on the job, you couldn't work, and you couldn't support your family, and there was really no system to deal with that. Being injured on the job meant destitution. It meant not being able to participate in the marketplace to support yourself, support your family. At best, you had the ability to sue your employer for damages. That was even then, and probably even more so, expensive and difficult. And there were some incidents in the 1910s, early teens, that really drew a particularly sharp picture of this. You've probably heard of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. This was a tragic accident in New York City that involved a fire in a clothing manufacturing facility that killed over 100 women. They were locked in the building, essentially. Fire equipment couldn't get to the floors that they were on. That and a number of incidents like it really put a focus on both worker safety as well as the system that dealt with how workers who had been injured could be taken care of. In 1913, Oregon passed a workers' compensation system, the Industrial Accident Insurance Fund, and that really, actually 100 years ago, this session was the beginning of trying to deal with that system in a way that worked better than what existed prior to that. Fast forward to the 1980s, and the system at 70 years old was really showing its age. We were coming out of the recession of the early 80s, and so the economy was very fragile. And that system that had evolved over the 70 years since 1913 had grown some glaring problems. It was really in crisis. It was very expensive. Oregon had, I think, the sixth most expensive workers' compensation premiums in the country, and it wasn't because we were providing marvelously generous benefits. In fact, we were providing very poor benefits for those dollars. The system was administratively cumbersome. There was very little connection to the worker safety system. There was no effort at all when an worker was injured to try to, in a programmatic sense, get them back on the job, getting them back to work. And the system was just frankly broken, was becoming a huge disincentive and a huge drag on the economy at that time. In 1990, the governor at the time called together a group of leaders of labor, management, business owners, and others in government to try to deal with that system. And what's colloquially become the Mahonia Hall. Mahonia Hall was itself actually just recently acquired as the governor's residence, and the Mahonia Hall agreements that came out of that system led to legislation in a special session in 1990, and then about two more bills in the subsequent sessions after that really dramatically changed the system. We added, and we've got some bullets there to show you, an emphasis on return to work, a stronger connection of worker safety and enforcement to the workers' compensation system, looked at how health care was delivered in the system and tried to reform that, and really tried to streamline and improve the administrative functioning of the system. And what we're going to do before we talk about the results of those changes, just I'm not going to read these aloud to you. I know you've got the presentation, but there are some terms that go by pretty regularly in workers' compensation that are sometimes a little bit baffling. But the notion of being partially disabled, being totally disabled, being disabled for a time while you're being treated before you go back to work versus permanently disabled, those are the kinds of things that that drive the system and are some of the terms that we'll use. What I'd like to do is go ahead and turn it over to John to talk about how that system that was in crisis in 1990 has changed with the Mahoney Hall agreements and some of the results that that has been able to generate for both businesses and for workers. John?
Thank you, Pat. Good morning. I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation System. I appreciate the invitation to be here this morning. First of all, the system results have been fairly dramatic. The one that we talk about a lot is the savings to employers since that time has been estimated to be over $20 billion in regard to premium costs that are saved compared to what employers were paying in premium before the reforms. But that's not where the results stop. We've got a story to tell about improved safety. And what this is a victory for everybody in Oregon. We have a system now where the accepted disabling claim rate, those claims that workers file that are accepted, where there's no doubt that the worker was hurt on the job, have dropped by over 56% since the reforms. Permanent and total disability claims, in terms of where workers are injured so significantly that they will never work again, have dropped by over 80% since 1991. And if you went back into the 1980s, that number would be dramatically larger. Fatalities. Workers who are killed on the job, that rate has dropped dramatically. And of course, that is a substantial, significant benefit to all who are concerned, especially the workers and their families.
And I just quickly want to interject, that first slide that we showed, the $20 billion, is often what we talk about in terms of savings and premiums. We don't talk about as often the dollar amounts related to workers, and this slide really shows a lot of that. This, the biggest benefit in the system are the people not hurt, the people not permanently disabled, and the people not killed, and that doesn't easily translate itself to just a straight dollar comparison, but it's hugely important in terms of benefits to workers.
This all occurred while employment in Oregon was growing. So while employment grows in Oregon over 30% during this time period, again, the accepted disabling claims are dropping from over 35,000 to under 19,000 a year. And of course, as we talked about, the premiums for Oregon's employers dropped by 63% during that time period. A little more on the claim denial rate declining. Some would argue that, well, what you've done is set up a system where worker claims are being denied more often, and that's how you are keeping the accepted disabling claim rate down. That's actually not what has occurred. The accepted disabling claim rate has remained in a fairly dropping fashion over the last few years, a few percent every few years. And so has the denial rate. And the denial rate has remained somewhat steady around 14 or 15% since 2006. Now, the denial rate did hit a high back in the early 1990s. In fact, it was 1990 of 21%, which is a very high denial rate. But it has never reached that since, and it's been dropping ever since.
Thank you,
Chair.
Thank you, Manager. I have a question about the denial rate. Is that denial rate based on the initial claim made for workers' comp?
Yes. This denial rate is for the initial whole claim that's filed. The denial rate for partial denials for you would have perhaps more than one condition. One is accepted. Maybe the second one is being litigated. That rate of denial has remained about the same as well. It's trending about the same way.
Thank you.
You're welcome. improve safety. This is just one more time. It's a pretty amazing accomplishment over the same period. Similar to estimates of the dropping cost to employers, this we took a shot at estimating, okay, what is the cumulative claims that we've avoided since 1990 because of the better safety, the better conditions within the workforce. And we estimated there have been 274 claims avoided since that time, if we had still been at the same level of claims rate as we were in 1990. Now, these are numbers that aren't scientific. This is a way to try to estimate the number of workers who did not get hurt, did not file claims, did not become permanently disabled, did not become permanently and totally disabled over that time period.
Now, a fairly obvious question to ask might be, well, isn't this driven by a change in the mix of Oregon's industry away from logging or natural resources or those sorts of things? And it's important to point out that although those changes certainly have occurred and contribute to this, in all industrial categories other than healthcare, the rates have been dropping over this period of time. So each and every industry is itself safer than it was, irrespective of the mix of how many people work in those industries.
Okay, along with that, we've had at least a decade, and I think more than a decade now, of a lot of work going on here in the legislature with increasing benefits to injured workers. And that was really the second half of the benefit of the reform. As employers were experiencing less workers getting hurt and saving costs themselves, we were able to start increasing benefits to workers. And as Pat mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, we had a system with high costs to employers and low benefits to workers, and we've been able to turn that around. The resolved claims at the beginning of this is just an indicator of the number of claims in the system between 1995 and 2011. The average TTD cost, or that's often called time loss, it's the wage replacement benefits for a worker who's at least temporarily disabled, has gone up 73% during that time period, and the average permanent disability benefit, it says PPD cost here, that'd be cost to the employers or insurers, has gone up 76%. So that's a benefit to workers who have a permanent disabling claim. Another slide on increased PPD benefits. This chart shows the maximum amounts of allowed payment of permanent disability benefits. As you can see, the maximum amounts have substantially, and I would say consistently, increased since the late 1980s.
And just again quickly, states that elsewhere in the country have looked at, well, how do we get our workers' comp costs under control? This is the kind of place that they go to first, is how do we cut benefit levels and how do we try to minimize use of the system? And we've been able in Oregon to do exactly the opposite, drive costs down while being able to provide better for workers who are injured and permanently disabled.
The big four reform successes, at least in our opinion, is number one, fewer injuries. We just have a lot less people getting hurt on the job or getting killed on the job, and that's a success, a win for everybody. We certainly have better claims and better medical practices today in Oregon. Workers' compensation is affordable to employers, and now we have good benefits and good outcomes for workers in our system. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, do we have any questions, the panelists? Okay, thank you very much for the presentation. Excuse me. Mr. Widener.
Might be something to get offline, but I'd be kind of curious what you have in reserves, total reserves, going back as far as you can for funding claims, where we are for premiums, all of that information, just see where we're at with employers.
Sure.
If we could be doing things less, or if there might be funds there that could be used for other things as well.
Yeah, Chair Doherty, Representative Widener, it's a great point and something we didn't touch on in terms of how the system actually works. In terms of providing those benefits in the main, the department itself doesn't actually do that. You know, what you do is you go out and you acquire workers' compensation insurance in the private sector, and those insurance companies, which are regulated by the department as well as insurance entities, maintain reserves, maintain those funds to be able to pay future claims. There is a fund that we do maintain that's the Worker Benefit Fund. That's the few cents per hour that shows up on your paycheck that pays for elements of the system. We'd be happy to get you data on that. But in the main, the actual worker benefits, the medical treatment, the survivor benefits, the income supplements, those kinds of things all come from private insurance providers.
Okay. Mr. Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great story, and I would love to have a copy of the presentation.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I close the informational hearing on the Workers' Comp Compensation Division and open a public hearing on House Bill 2069. Jan, if you could summarize the bill, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, this bill authorizes the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to order the payment of temporary disability compensation for up to 21 months for certain injured workers in vocational assistance training.
Okay. We have three people signed up, Grace Smith, John Schultz again, and Kathy Wallace. If you'd like to come up. Thank you. If you can remember to identify yourself for the record, whoever's going first.
I guess I will be.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, representatives. Thanks so much for allowing us to come testify this morning. I'm Grace Smith, and this is Kathy Wallace, and we're both representing the Oregon Association of Rehabilitation Professionals. We provide vocational services to injured workers in Oregon, and unlike the people who came previously, we don't have a growler. We don't have any injured workers with us this morning. But we are very serious in saying that we believe that because of what we do, we actually work with injured workers who are found eligible for vocational services because of their injury. And over the past 30 years that I've been doing this, there's certainly been a decrease, as John and Patrick mentioned. But what we've become concerned about in the last number of years is the length of training for injured workers. This bill, sponsored by Representative Kennemer, and we want to thank him very much for sponsoring something that we think is critical to the workers we work with, would allow the director once again to extend wage replacement benefits up to 21 months for a worker. That was something that was allowable under previous administrative rules, but in 2009 there was a bill that was sponsored, I think, by DCBS to streamline some language so that they would not have to be involved in some of the mundane aspects, the housekeeping aspects of retraining. And as part of that, there was some language that was put in it which inadvertently reduced the length of time or the length of time that insurers have to pay wage replacement benefits. They can elect to pay them up to 21 months, but currently they're only required to pay them to 16 months. And it's because of that that we are here to support this bill.
Thank you.
Well, what
if you push the microphone over to you, thank you.
What we do is help,
and if you could identify yourself.
Kathy Wallace. What we do is help injured workers develop training programs, and what we're required to do under Oregon administrative rules is to get a retraining program that will get them back to a wage as close as possible to their wage of injury. So, and if a worker has an exceptional loss of earnings under Oregon administrative rules, they can get a program over 16 months up to 21 months. Currently, very few injured workers are able to, if they qualify for that, are able to actually accept such a program because they financially can't fund themselves. So they are forced to do a lesser program under 16 months. So if you have someone that makes a wage, so let's just say his wage was $33 an hour, an associate degree program might get him closer. But if he doesn't have the money, and most of them don't, for living expenses for, say, two additional months, they are forced to accept a lesser program.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
And we've been asked in the past, this is Grace Smith again, we've been asked in the past how many injured workers this might affect. And we know that in the year 2009, that was the last year that we have department statistics, 635 people were found eligible for and participated in retraining. Of that, of course, a huge percentage are not the high wage earners or people with exceptional disabilities, somebody maybe with a loss of limb. So we think that there's going to be considerably fewer than that. John may have statistics, we do not, but just kind of in talking with some of our colleagues, we think that would be less than 10% of those 635 that were found eligible in 2009. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. John?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'll keep my remarks very brief. We did manage a bill that was passed in 2009, which inadvertently removed the department's ability to take action when a worker appeals the insurer's decision about providing wage replacement benefit during the workers' retraining program that lasts beyond 16 months. This bill simply reinstates the department's authority to order an extension of benefits at the worker's request. The department had legislation in 2011 that would have addressed this issue, but the bill wasn't enacted for reasons that were unrelated to this provision. The Management Labor Advisory Committee has reviewed this bill and unanimously voted to recommend it to the committee.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have any questions? So basically what it is, a worker can be out for 16 months but only gets, or for 21 months, but only gets a wage replacement for 16.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
And so what happens is the first 5 months, they don't have any income.
Well, the first 5 months?
Yes, because they have to be employable at the end. So the time loss would not kick in until there was only 16 months left.
Thank you. Mr. Holvey?
Thank you. That almost answered my question. So right now what this bill does is it gives the authority to the director to order the payment for 21 months. But I noticed in the current ORS, I guess, that the programs may be paid for longer periods than 21 months, according to the language, and I wonder how that happens.
I don't think the rules allow for over 21 months.
No, they do not currently.
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, I think you're correct that the law does specify that the programs may be paid for longer than 21 months, but the temporary disability must end at that time. And I think that the answer you probably just received from two very experienced counselors indicates that that's a very, very rare event if it ever happens at all. Most of these programs don't last beyond 21 months.
Most aren't over 18, actually.
And the reason for that is that most people can have a chance for an associate degree in that length of time. Obviously, it's very, very unusual for someone to get a bachelor's degree or further education and training. But someone who's just finished high school might be able to just jump right in and finish an associate degree in 18 months. But someone who's been out of school for 20 years, they may need to take some prerequisite courses, which is, I think, why we came up in the original plan with kind of 21 months, is that would allow a quarter for them to take prerequisite courses and to get back on track and in a place where they could potentially finish an associate degree.
Thank you. I think that clears up my confusion about what the statute says, but not quite. But thank you for your explanation.
Okay, thank you. Representative Fagan?
Madam Chair, are we going to hear from DCBS on this? I would just be curious if they agree that the previous, oh, you guys are with them?
No.
Oh, he's, okay. I'm sorry, I missed that part. So you guys agree that it was a housekeeping measure, that this was an unintended consequence of the previous legislation? Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Fagan, yes, we do, and we take responsibility for that housekeeping error. It was our error.
Well, so what I should learn is that Pat is not the only employee of ECBS. Is that what I learned?
By quite a margin.
Thank you.
Is the only one.
He works real hard. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I have closed the public hearing on House Bill 2069. And we were going to have a work session on 2590, but we're going to carry it over. We're going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2590 to Wednesday as we await a fiscal impact statement. It's not been issued yet. So anything else? Okay, with that, I close the work. Yes.
I said thank you.
Okay, thank you. I close the work session on how adjourn the meeting of the House Committee on Business and Labor. Thank you very much.